Peter Richelieu, A Soul's Journey, a fantastic informative book from experiences from the 40 THS on the afterlife, astral travels and more. About this book, readers say, while in a state of despair after the death of his brother, the author living in the East, is visited by Acharya, an Indian mystic. Using astral projection, Acharya takes him out of the physical world onto the astral planes of the afterlife. Each astral plane teaches something new about life and death, karma and the ego. Through a series of meetings with the dead, including his brother, the author comes to realize how irrational it is to fear death. Through his teaching, Acharya opens up a whole vision of life in the world that follows this, a world where anything is possible. Based on notes taken immediately following out-of-body experiences, this book is both enlightening and absorbing. It gives the reader a direct insight into the unknown mysteries of life and death. Superbly incredible book. As good and I think a bit more better and detailed than Robert Munro's beautiful classic works on same subject. I read this book in 1992 and it changed my life. I practiced the exercises set out in the book, visualization, remembering, noting dreams on waking, etc., and after a relatively short period of time I experienced many, forward. In spite of the fact that I am no writer and claim no gifts or experience in that direction, this book is given to the world without apology, for I am carrying out orders from those who must be obeyed. The part of the book, which will hold the interest of the largest number of readers, is that which begins at chapter 4. For those people who have no recollection of their life and activities during sleep, even this part will contain many completely new ideas. As many of these calls for explanation, readers are advised to avoid the temptation of skimming quickly through the preliminary chapters in order to reach this one more quickly. These introductory chapters, which are written in the form of talks by a Hindu guru, are so filled with vital information that they hold the key not only to what follows in the book, but to what happens to all of us at one time or another. Those who read them slowly and carefully and who refer to them often, will glean the most general information and acquire the best groundwork for the appreciation of the story, which follows. In writing down my experiences, I have added no embellishments. If these experiences help a few of you to understand the scheme of life and so be comforted, if they give you an insight into the nature of evolution and provide you with a reason for making friends of animals, they will not have been written in vain. Peter Richelieu. Prologue. It was the 7th of July 1941, and I was still brooding over a cable I had received from the War Office in London 3 days before, telling me that Charles, my dear young brother, had been killed in action over England. He was only 23, more than a year before he had joined the RAF and qualified as a pilot. Of course we were proud of him, who would not want to join the RAF if he were 21 years of age, fit as a fiddle and eager to do his bit for the old country. Naturally we knew that the life of a pilot was precarious, but somehow it did not seem that anything could happen to him. People are often like that with those they love, and Charles and I had always been closer to each other than ordinary brothers, although there was a difference of 10 years in our ages. I remembered the first time he proudly told us he had downed his first enemy plane. The initial shock from the news of Charles's death was severe, and now, for the first time in my life, I felt bitter against the powers that be, the beneficent creator who is talked of so glibly. How could he be beneficent if he allowed the innocent to be killed? I had been brought up a Catholic, not a very strict one perhaps, and I had taken many things for granted, in the way Christians do. Religion was part of one's life and, on certain days, time had to be given to it. At other times one did not think very much about what was expected of a Christian, a follower of Christ. Now I thought about these things for the first time, and I did not feel that I wanted to go to church, certainly not to a priest. I did not want to pray. Why should I? God had taken away from me the dearest thing I possessed in the world, and although I did not curse God, I certainly came very near to hating him. A friend had told me that Charles was well out of this war, that the next world was most certainly a better place than this one at the moment, and that I should be thankful. But I was not thankful. I had so much looked forward to see his cheery face and hear his hearty laugh at his next leave, which we had arranged to spend together. Now the future was a blank. It was in just this mood that I sat on the never-to-be-forgotten morning a few weeks ago, the day he came. Although now, judging from the change, which has taken place in me, it seems as if it could all have taken place in a former existence, yet I can remember every detail, and shall until I die. I shall try to tell the story just as it happened, but if the recording seems to be disjointed, you must forgive me, for I have never tried to write a story before and only do so now because I want others to be comforted, even as I was comforted. About 11 o'clock on that morning there was a knock at the door, and my servant told me that there was a man in the hall who wished to see me. "What sort of man?" I asked. His reply was, "A strange man, master. I think perhaps he come to beg." I told the boy to go down and inquire what this man wanted and to come back to let me know. On his return he said that the man had a message, which could only be given to me, so with some irritation I told him to bring the man up. Even though I have seen this man very often since then, I still find it difficult to describe him, but I shall do my best. He was tall, slim, about 45 years of age and wore a beard. He was unmistakably a native of northern India, though his skin was almost as white as mine. He was dressed in a simple Indian costume made of material so indiscriminate in color, that at first sight one might have thought it was dirty, but on closer inspection one saw that it was spotlessly clean. His feet were encased in sandals and he wore a turban. I told the boy to go, and asked my visitor to sit down. He sat down, not on the chair that I had indicated but cross-legged on the carpet. It was then that I noticed the benevolent expression of his eyes, which seemed to contain the wisdom of the ages. So far he had not spoken. "Well," I said, "what can I do for you?" He seemed surprised at the question, and took a few seconds to answer it. "You sent for me," he said. This was too much for me, so I replied, "What on earth do you mean? I've never set eyes on you before. So am I likely to have sent for you? Come on, tell me what you want, for I have work to do." "You sent for me," he repeated, and I suppose the surprise I felt must have been evident in my expression, for he smiled and continued, "Have you not just lost your brother? Is not it true that you have been asking many questions of a hidden providence, whom you accuse of being instrumental in taking your brother from you? Have not you said many times, why should such things be? Why should he be taken and not others? What is the use of believing in a God, when you cannot ask him questions and get from him the answers to those questions, which mean so much to you? For the last 3 nights, when you have slept, you have dreamt that you have been talking to your brother. You have been talking to him, you have asked these questions and many others during these hours of fitful sleep. I am the answer to these questions. I am the messenger who has been sent to make these things clear to you, for did not Christ say, ask and it shall be given to you, knock and it shall be opened unto you? You have asked, you have knocked, and it now rests with you whether you still wish to have the answers you have so often clamored for. Of course I want to hear the answers to my questions, I said, but who are you and how do I know that you can tell me what I want to know? Surely you are a man the same as I, alive and in the flesh, yet you talk of knowing my brother, of talking to him, of hearing me ask the very questions that I have asked. Is this magic, or am I dreaming? Convince me, if you can. You'll find me a good listener, not very credulous I'm afraid, but as you seem to know so much about me already, I'll listen to what you have to say." Then he said, "I am afraid it will take some time to make you understand, but if you are willing to spare the time, I will come to you for an hour or two most days, until my story is concluded. I cannot promise that you will be convinced by all I have to tell you, but I can promise that at least you will be happier than you are now, so for that reason alone, perhaps the time will not entirely be wasted. Is 11 o'clock each morning suitable for you? I said, yes, oh yes, rather wondering what I had let myself in for, but at the same time feeling that I could get rid of him after the first day, if I found there was a catch in the thing. I looked up to carry on the conversation, but he had gone. There was no one there, although I had not heard the door open or shut. I began to wonder if I had dreamt it all or whether my brain had become a little deranged, owing to worry and lack of sleep. I even sent for my servant and asked him if he really had brought a man up to see me. When he said he had, I asked if he had seen him go, but he said he had not and resolutely denied that anyone could have left my room and gone out by the front door without his seeing him. That did not help, and I still wondered if it had been a dream, for somehow the statement of the boy, that he had brought the man to me, seemed unreal. I decided to wait for the morrow. 11 o'clock was the time he had fixed, and I was certainly going to be in my room at that hour, to see whether he came or not. Oddly enough, I slept that night as I had not slept since I had received that fateful cable. When I woke in the morning, I seemed to have been talking to Charles and telling him about my visitor. In my dreaming, Charles did not seem to be at all surprised, and I woke with a certainty that my Indian friend would turn up as arranged. I decided I would ask him as soon as he arrived how he had managed to go without being seen or heard. I suppose my door must have been ajar, partly open, for just on 11 o'clock a pleasant voice at my elbow said, "Well, do you still want those questions answered?" I had not heard him come, but in a strange way was so reassured by his presence that I replied, "Certainly, I am ready." Without any more casual conversation, he sat down on the floor. I leant back in my chair, and he started to tell me the most amazing story I have ever heard, a story that even now I cannot fully understand, but one which rang true from the first word, a story which I feel will ring true for others who may read it. During all the days which followed, we had little conversation. He came, just as he had done the first day. Sometimes he talked for an hour, sometimes longer, and when he had finished for the morning, he put the palms of his hands together in Eastern fashion and went away. I rather think he sensed when I had had enough, when my brain, reeling with strange facts, had reached a stage at which it could take in no more, for I noticed that he sometimes finished suddenly, and without a word of farewell left the room, to return the following morning, when, without any fresh introduction, he started to speak as if he had just finished the sentence with which his previous day's discourse was completed. Acharya should make more visits in the coming day. Chapter 1. I have not come to convert you to any new faith, any new philosophy. I have not been sent to you by him who is my master to provide answers to the questions which puzzle you at present. The only way in which I can do this is to tell you about the fundamental facts of life in the hope that this will give you a foundation of knowledge through which you can build up a philosophy of your own. I shall also assist you in gaining practical experience, through which you can prove things for yourself. Much of what I say will sound unusual to you, but, in many lives, I have studied much and had proof of which has convinced me that certain facts are true. I have no desire that you accept what I say as facts or truth, for you can only do so when you get to know such things within your own consciousness. There is an old saying of the Lord Buddha, who founded the religion which bears his name, which illustrates my point. One day one of his disciples came to him and said, "Lord, whom shall I believe? One man telleth me this and another that, and both seem sure they are right." The Lord Buddha replied, "My son, believe not that which any man saith, not even I, the Lord Buddha, unless it appeals to your common sense. And even then do not believe it, but treat it as a reasonable hypothesis, until such time as you can prove it for yourself. First of all, I shall give you a rough outline of the path, which is called evolution, and of how that indefinable thing called life is found to flow through the kingdoms of nature. Of the source of life, I can give you no idea. I do not know, and I have never met anyone who did. But does that matter? All thinking men are agreed that there must be a creative power behind the universe, Whether we think of that power as a personal God or just the power of creation, does not seem to be a matter of great importance. There are many who still like to think of God as a venerable old man with a beard, an idealistic figure based on the highest that each person can imagine, but with unlimited powers and an understanding of justice that is unequaled amongst men. Who shall say that such an idea is foolish? It may satisfy many, but it has no foundation in fact, for no man lives whom can speak with knowledge of either the creation of the universe or of that thing which we call life. Although we cannot analyze life, we can contact it. Who has not seen an animal or a human, living 1 minute and dead the next? What has happened during that minute? Certainly something has gone out of the body which one saw in action, and left behind the still flesh, which, even as one looks, seems to start to disintegrate and return to Mother Earth. So we can recognize life as a fact, although we may not be able to understand it, and certainly we cannot create it as we can so many other things in these enlightened days. The mind of man has produced many synthetic aids to nature, but not synthetic life. The world of science tells us that life is found in all the four kingdoms of nature: the mineral, vegetable, animal and human kingdoms. We do not need to be told that there is life in the animal and human kingdoms. We can see that for ourselves, but it is more difficult to credit that there is life in the mineral and vegetable kingdoms also. Reliable sources tell us that even rocks have life, and that when the life force is withdrawn from such rocks, they commence to decay. In time they crumble and return to the dust, much as a human body does, though the process takes a longer time. It is certainly easier for us to accept the fact that vegetables have life than that rocks have, for when they are withdrawn from the ground, the source of life in their case, we see for ourselves that they wither and die. In due time they become dust, as do all living things when the life force is withdrawn. Philosophers trace life still further into an additional kingdom, which they term the superhuman kingdom. For when man has conquered the human kingdom, his evolution does not come to a sudden end, but goes on upwards, ever upwards, until at last it reaches the source from which it sprang. How many countless ages before this one, no mere man has been able even to guess. They state further that life is progressive, as are all things in nature, and that the goal of life is experience. This it garners and harvests as it progresses through the kingdom of nature, from the lowest form in which life is found, to the highest, which can be described as the perfect man, or a man made perfect. Next we must consider what is the difference between life as found in the mineral kingdom and life as we know it in the animal and human kingdoms. Its essence is undoubtedly the same, for, as I have stated, the origin of all life is divine, but how different is its expression? When life starts functioning as various minerals, it has no individuality as we understand such a thing at the human level. In the lower types of minerals, the life force, after having gained the experience it must obtain, passes into the higher forms. Later it passes to the lower type of vegetable, and so to the higher types of the same kingdom. All this takes many thousands of years as time is reckoned on this planet, but it is only when life passes from the vegetable to the animal kingdom that any sort of division becomes apparent. Even at this stage there is no individuality, but merely a group consciousness or group soul, common to all the different animals of the same species, which works on and directs these animals from without. When the life force passes to the human kingdom, an indwelling spirit or ego inhabits each individual body and dictates the thoughts and actions of every human being. At this stage of evolution, group souls have an influence upon races, but none on individuals, who now have free will. To animals, man is a superanimal, just as to man, a perfect man is a superman. It is unfortunate to find that this superanimal is inclined to act with cruelty to his younger brothers rather than with compassion and understanding. In fact, he seems to be the main cause of the suffering they undergo. If man killed only for the purpose of obtaining food, as animals do, or because a wild animal is threatening to kill him, that might be regarded as conforming to the laws of nature, but he tortures animals by various means so that his women folk may be adorned with furs and feathers, and he kills for what he terms sport when he practices his skill in marksmanship, regardless of the suffering he may cause to those not so well equipped as himself. All this thoughtless cruelty brings into manifestation the emotion of fear, the most retarding of all emotions. Fear of the superanimal begins in the lowest forms of animal life and continues throughout the animal kingdom, till animals contact man in domestic life. Then the fear that was born in the early stages is slowly but surely replaced by love. Until this happens, the progress of animals along the evolutionary path is slow. I shall trace for you the passage of the life force through the animal kingdom. Try to imagine the life force as constituting the water of a slowly moving canal. It is bounded on both sides by the banks of the canal, thus giving the impression of a controlled purpose. There is practically no difference in this stream when passing through the mineral and vegetable kingdoms, but there is a distinct change as it emerges from the canal into the conditions ruling in the animal kingdom. The animal kingdom is a complex structure of different levels of evolution, from microbes and worms, through the wild animals of the jungle, to the animals which man has domesticated. In passing through the animal kingdom, the life force acquires the coloration of experience. It takes form as, shall we say, myriads of tadpoles. The life force was contained in the larvae which were produced by a frog. In due course it emerged as many thousands of tadpoles. These were born to contact life and to gain experience, which will color the water that was clear. Many tadpoles die in infancy, never reaching their destiny as frogs, and these units of water may be said to return to the soul groups scarcely colored at all. Some become frogs, and although through lack of food or for a thousand different reasons their lives may be short, when they eventually come to an end, the units of water comprising these young frogs return to their soul groups, colored only with the small experience of discomfort or suffering due to the cause of their deaths. Others live longer and in due course contact human life. The frog learns to fear its tormentors, to run from them, to hide when possible and avoid contact with them. In due course it varies either by a natural death, which in the majority of cases is unlikely, by the unthinking cruelty of the human kingdom or by an attack from one of the natural enemies of frogs, such as snakes. When the units of water comprising these fragments of life return to the compartments, their experience most certainly colors the water, which when it started out was clear, with many colors expressing its sufferings in its diverse forms. The whole experience, blended together, leaves that compartment colored with the experiences of all the units, none of which has a separate identity, all being part of the complete group soul. After one or two lives at this stage of evolution, the life force with its accumulated water experiences passes to the next level. Instead of tens of thousands of tadpoles, it is divided into about 10,000 units of rats, or mice, for example. The rat is born with a fear of the human being and of its natural enemies, for is not the water colored with the fear that was brought back from the lives lived in the earlier stage? In this series of lives, fear continues to grow. In his early life, the rat is taught by bitter experience to avoid man at all costs, to work by night when man is less of a terror than by day, and if he manages to live to a ripe old age, it is certainly due to his cunning and mastery of methods of circumventing his natural enemies. While I was still pondering his final words, I looked up and the room was empty. I sat quite still for a while and tried to grasp the idea of what he had said, and after a time, much of it came back. At first I did not consider whether I believed it or not, that did not seem to matter. It was all so new but it certainly was interesting. Already, although I was tired, I began to look forward to the morrow, for was confident he would return. The following day I sat at my desk with my eyes on the door. I was determined I would be on the lookout to see if he opened the door or came through it. But if I expected something supernatural to happen I was disappointed, for just on 11 o'clock the door opened noiselessly in the ordinary way and he greeted me, as I should have expected him to do, just by saying, "Well, are you ready to hear more?" Or did I bore you yesterday? I suppose my reply must have satisfied him, for he continued from where he left off. The most evolved of this group are the cattle, for they are often stall-fed in the winter months, and it is generally admitted that the providing of food for an animal does more to gain its confidence and eradicate its natural fear of man than anything else. Slowly but surely some of this fear of the human race is obliterated and the group soul is ready to pass into its last stage in the animal world, that of the truly domesticated animals, the horse, the dog, and the cat. The group soul which in the beginning went out seeking experience in the form of approximately 10,000 tadpoles, has gradually but surely divided itself into fewer and fewer parts, until in the last stages of the animal kingdom, it is in two parts only, as two horses, two dogs or two cats. When the group soul has evolved to the stage where it is divided in half, it is in every way domesticated and has come to understand man as he really is. Now the possibility of its individualizing as a separate human ego becomes a fact. How many lives still have to be lived by this group soul, depends entirely on the human beings to whom these two animals are attached. If one of the two owners of these horses, dogs or cats is not an animal lover and therefore the treatment meted out to the animal is unsympathetic, or cruel, then some of the fear which in the last 20 lives has been partly eradicated, will come back again and more lives must be lived before individualization can take place. I cannot emphasize too often or too strongly that if people realized how important it is for them to make friends of all domestic animals and do their part in making them understand man, then this last stage would be reached much more quickly than is often the case. Please understand this clearly. No group soul can individualize into a human soul until all fear of the human race has been overcome. Love is not an emotion which relates exclusively to the human kingdom. In its highest form it encompasses all nature. Therefore man's part in animal evolution is to see that in the true sense perfect love casteth out fear, for, without understanding help, the progress of animals on the evolutionary path can be retarded for an unlimited period of time. How does individualization eventually take place? It can come about in one of two ways, through the pathway of either the heart or the head, which varies with the type of animal. It can be said that a dog most frequently passes into the human kingdom through love and/or sacrifice. Often a dog is so devoted to his master or to the family of his adoption, that in an emergency his instinct of self-preservation completely deserts him and he sacrifices his life to save that of his master or a member of the family. It is not essential for the dog to have made the supreme sacrifice of its life for the group soul to individualize. When a dog has learned all the lessons it was meant to learn in the animal kingdom and when all fear of the human race has been eradicated, it would be a waste of time for the group soul to continue with more incarnations in animal form. Its destiny is then elsewhere, so a transfer to a new and more enlightened sphere of existence takes place. The first incarnation in a human body is not necessarily passed in a body as undeveloped as the lowest type of human being on the earth, for often the new ego, through having gained much experience in its last few lives in the animal kingdom, especially one who has given up his own life for a human, has earned the right of a human body slightly more developed than the most undeveloped type found in the world. A horse individualizes in a way similar to that of a dog, by outstanding devotion to its master. Often one has heard of a horse making a stupendous effort when called upon to do so, only to drop down dead when the effort has been successful. While a dog or horse passes into the human kingdom through devotion and/or sacrifice, so a cat earns the right to live as a higher entity by learning to understand man. In olden days many philosophers said that a dog and a horse earned the right to progress by devotion, whereas a cat employs cunning, the first glimmering of the faculty of reason. We can see instances of elephants who have been trained to serve man, and monkeys who have lived in the right types of zoological gardens, who obviously qualify in this respect, and in surroundings devoid of fear they have used their brains and so can be said to understand, to a limited extent, the ways of man. Animals, which miss out a life as domesticated animals, go into the lowest form of human body that is known in the world.